You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. We're jumping back into our live event with Head of TED Talks, Chris Anderson, for this episode. If you didn't catch part one, just pop back an episode and get up to speed. As the head of TED, Chris has been at the forefront of the Ideas platform that's been a go-to for some of the world's most influential thinkers to spread their worldview for the last two decades. He has a new book which draws from some of those learnings, Infectious Generosity. The book offers more of not only the smart thinking that Chris has been a part of at TED for many years, but also real-world case studies showing how a more generous outlook on life can make a real difference. Joining Chris on stage to discuss the book is John Ronson. John is the writer and podcaster behind books including The Psychopath Test, The Men Who Stare at Goats, and So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Most recently, you might know John from his hit podcast, Things Fell Apart. Let's jump back in now. This is John Ronson with the head of TED, Chris Anderson, discussing infectious generosity. We rejoin the conversation with John wondering about whether we can really find genuine positivity in the online world.
So I want to move on to what is, you know, definitely the most provocative, but not, you know, in a way I completely understand, but it is a really interesting point. You say something, you know, big and surprising, which is that the internet tracking and surveilling us and everybody constantly checking our reputations has its upsides, and that overall, quote, it's a force for good. Now, you're making a nuanced point. You know, you're saying that you're very much against the excesses of surveillance culture from the tech companies and quote-unquote cancel culture. So it's not like you've, you know, not seen what's been happening all of these years. And one thing that I found really interesting is that you equate it to religion. You say that in the absence of religion, people, you know, a good thing about religion was people felt like they were being watched. And now we don't feel like we're being watched. So, yeah.
So, look, it is a controversial point. And you can blame this on my religious past, if you like. My parents were missionaries. I grew up believing God was watching me every moment of every day. And that really every day, in a way, was a battle between our inner demons and angels. And that, you know, we had to fight. And there was fear in it. There was some fear. Like, if I did something wrong, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, what does that mean? My honest assessment of myself looking back is that that fear, weirdly, helped me be, on many occasions, a slightly better version of myself. And I am worried that in the current one reason why the world is getting a bit meaner is that we've let go of religion. I've let go of religion personally. We've let it go, and we're trying to build civilization in a brand new experiment that no one's done this in any time in human history, of run societies without any religious space for all of the last, you know, thousands of years, as far as we know. The religions have gathered people at least weekly and reminded them to be their best selves. So, the question is, can the internet play a role actually in doing that? I think the world, in general, a world of growing transparency, I would argue is good. In terms of countries, it's been good. There's a wonderful nonprofit called Transparency International that ranks countries according to how corrupt they are. And that has had a material effect in reducing corruption in the world. And I think even though it's uncomfortable having it feel like everyone is watching us and that at any point something we do, people could jump on us. I mean, it's horrible being jumped on by the internet, it really is. But it's possible that those safeguards may actually be, it's possible that humans are so screwed up, and we are, honestly, like we're very fragile, weird beings. It's possible we need a little bit of fear in our lives to be our best selves. You don't have to believe this to actually accept some of the rest of the book, put it down to my hands. But that's what I think. And so I just think that the bigger point, John, is that reputation is the number one currency in this age. And if you commit to being generous, if you commit to giving things away and acting in a generous spirit online, that reputation long-term is going to help you, I think. I think it will win you allies, people who want to work with you, people who want to do things with you. That is worth fighting for.
I thought it was a really interesting and counterintuitive point. And the first time I read it, I thought, well, whoa. And then I read the book a second time. And I thought, huh, yeah, like I got it. And you know, and I agree with everything that you just said. You know, and also, you know, even though I wrote a book about public, you know, this critical of public shaming, I see the importance of shame. I think if people do bad things, they should feel ashamed. And one of the problems with the modern age is that we've overused our shaming weapon.
Yes, yes.
And as a result, transgressors have become like hospital superbugs, like impervious to treatment. Mm. They've become these like shame-free. People realize, well, if we just step out of the pact by refusing to feel ashamed, then the shamers have nowhere to go. So we've actually created a world. And actually, I think something really interesting, this isn't my original thought, this is from Katie Herzog, the podcaster, but I heard her say that, you know, one positive thing that's come from Elon Musk's Twitter, like not much positive has come from it, but one positive thing is that there isn't that sort of punitive left-wing bullying on Twitter anymore. That's kind of gone. And they've migrated to people, places like Blue Sky,
yeah.
and it's fractured and they don't have that power anymore. But in its place is increasing right-wing bullying of these like shameless trolls who've just become extreme versions of themselves.
It's challenging.
You say that... And I agree with it. You say that, you know, being afraid that your reputation is going to get destroyed can lead to sensible self-censorship. And I agree. And I think it's positive. You know, we don't want to just be assholes going around insulting people all the time. But I think it can also lead to kind of frightened self-censorship, which is a threat to public discourse and free speech.
So I agree with that too. Like it's that there's a line where the whole thing goes horribly wrong. The main point I want to make is that what's amazing about the connected age is that you can be generous, you can spread things far and wide with zero cost. Those things carry with them reputation, and reputation is everything, good and bad. But it's the potential to enhance your reputation is massive in a way that was never possible before.
Yeah. There's another downside I wanted to point out, which is that a complaint that you hear on the right quite often is the quote, be kind brigade, people like us, can often be like the worst. Because if you get it wrong, then you're not displaying empathy. You're displaying highly selective empathy. You're displaying empathy for people in your own group who agree with the things that you agree with, but the people who fall outside of our group, we have no empathy at all, and it's creating a world of heroes and villains.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important forms of generosity today is people who have the courage to step outside of that mode and find a way to listen to people who are other with respect. Just listen to them. And, you know, my mother insisted on me, and this was such a powerful lesson. You just can't, you're not allowed to judge someone until you really know their story. And by the way, when you really know their story, you won't judge them. So I think this is profoundly true, and we've lost this in our righteous certainty about how bad everything is on the other side and so forth. We've lost the chance to learn from each other. We've lost our curiosity. And people who with courage and curiosity go out there and say, wait a sec, maybe there's something I could learn. And maybe we have to find ways to bridge between these sides. And
so how? Because like you're speaking, my language here. Like, this is exactly what I feel too. And I guess the question is like, how, practically speaking, how do you reach out to somebody? It does work. That story I said before about Megan Phelps Roper going on Twitter to proselytize for that crazy church that she belonged to, and in fact Twitter took her away from the church. So yeah. It does work. So is it respectful listening? It's certainly not trying to beat people down with arguments. That doesn't work.
Yeah. I think it's coming away from the sort of one-line zingers and the loathing and the snark and the performative side of social media to the sort of the listening and reasoned side. There's a different mode of conversation you can find when you say, just, I hear you, and I think I understand part of why you're saying that, but I'm puzzled about this. Aren't you worried about this? As opposed to, look, everyone, at how ridiculous this person is being.
It's leading somebody to a place where they will figure it out for themselves,
yeah,
as opposed to try to browbeat people into changing their opinion.
I tell the story in the book of this incredible African-American musician, Darryl Davis, who was puzzled by why people hated him because of the color of his skin. So he went and he sought out a meeting with the local leader of the Ku Klux Klan. So this is as bridging as you can get and as crazy courageous as you can get. They had a meeting, it was terrifying. Somehow they continued to meet, they formed a weird friendship. He went to KKK rallies in his efforts to understand his friend better. His friend ended up leaving the KKK. Dozens of others followed. CNN then ran a story on this, which millions of people heard. He's got a TEDx talk that millions of people have seen. So one person's courage has sparked this viral chain reaction of news and shown, I mean, look, if he can bridge with the KKK, I think we can bridge with someone who's pissing us off on X right now. I really think we probably can. And it's just, still, it takes courage because people on your own side will try and blow your head off. Don't be so nice to that thug. Well, if we all go that way, we're just not going to solve any problems. And part of it, if you pull the camera back, we are spending so much energy in this one-dimensional tug of war. It's just a battle for power. It's a mud fight. This is ignoring humans' true superpowers, which is to dream of a better future. It's to dream of new possibilities. Where actually, if you reframe the problem, people can find ways to maybe work together. And as soon as people start to actually build something together, even if they disagree about some things, they change how they think of each other. We somehow have to get back into that mode. I really think that, or I think we're screwed.
I hope this isn't a difficult question, and feel free to deflect or not answer if it is. But does this philosophy of not being in a bubble, listening to all voices, bringing other voices in, is that impacting the way that you're curating TED, that you're bringing in voices who you may not have brought in a few years ago?
It is. Where TED is probably viewed by most people and probably an objective look at, like, most of the content we have is technology and science, whatever. It's not really political, but the stuff that you could put on a political spectrum, which might be less than a quarter of the content, but of that stuff, most of it leans progressive, for sure.
Where but you have York. Started to bring in.
Exactly.
And they've got into some trouble for it.
Indeed. I feel quite strongly that we have to be open tent, that we can't just apply. Because the world's getting more and more politicized to the point where if people perceive you in one camp, they won't even listen to you. You're done. And so your chance of persuading the people you most want to persuade is gone. That's no good. So no, we're determined to take the very uncomfortable path of trying to find voices that are uncomfortable to our progressive audience and say, could we learn something from this person? I mean, it's a question for you, you know, is it possible to is it possible to do these two things? Strongly disagree with someone, strongly dislike someone, if you like, but also learn something from them. I think it might be. We're definitely trying to find out, and I think...
And it's been causing some ructions.
It's definitely causing ructions. It's also causing delight and excitement, because there are some people who don't like, you know, that, you know, we've sort of drifted into one particular part. They want TED. We're a nonpartisan organization, and so I'm determined to keep it that way. And I find it very, very, very exciting. I think the next TED is going to be the most controversial we've had, probably, and I think it's going to be great for that reason.
I want to end with something really interesting and something that I very much agree with. You say a few times in the book that generosity, like an act of generosity, can make you feel happy in a way that you don't anticipate, you know, until you do it. And I've got to say, it bears it out. I'm about to tell a story about how amazing I am. I was on a train, and it was like chaos. I was coming back from Cardiff, and I had a seat, but there were like 400 people who didn't. And there was an old lady right in front of me who was clearly like getting more and more pained. And I offered her my seat. And she was like, oh, no, it's fine, don't worry. And I was going, no, I've sat down for long enough. It's, you know, please sit down. And she did. And for the rest of the day, I honestly was bouncing around with joy. I think if I hadn't done it, I would have felt real guilt, the kind of religious guilt that you talk about a little bit in the book. I'm sure there's a kind of element of OCD to it, a kind of scrupulosity, a fear of doing the wrong thing morally. So there was that. I avoided feelings of guilt. And it just made me feel so happy to have done the right thing. I was surprised by how happy it made me.
So it's a really, really weird part of our psychology, actually, that we don't fully predict how much happiness comes from being kind. Like, most of our psychology, you know, we think, if I get that thing I've been dreaming of, I know that's going to make me happy. And we know that, you know, I fall in love with someone, if I can persuade that person to love me, I'm going to be happy. That part is true. But when it comes to generosity, even though we're wired to be generous, we also have these other feelings like loss aversion that muddle us and get in the way of really understanding the full set of benefits. So no, if it turns out that one of the keys to a life of meaning and a life of happiness, along with meaningful work and nature and good relationships and so forth, but right up there, one of the four or five top things is to be generous. We're wired to do it. And after the event, this little whisper says, wow, I like this version of myself. Well done you. You know, this is great. Mm. And it makes it easier to do it the next time. It's a really beautiful thing. And it's a fact about us that I just wish was widely known. I mean, it should be one of the first things that's taught in school and in life and so forth, because we honestly need every little piece that we can get to help us go down this journey. It's hard to come out of our busy, stressful lives and try and spend any attention on anything else than that. It's really hard to do.
So generosity can make your business more successful in tangible, money-making ways, and it can make your mental health better by just making you feel more happy. And you end your book with, you say that you've started... There's a theme in your book about, you know, we're living in a post-religious age, and you say that, I think it was Alan de Botton says that, you know, atheists should practice some things that religious people practice, like meeting once a week, and you are doing that yourself. You're tithing, you're giving away 10% of your income.
There are actually two big religious traditions out there for giving away money. The Judeo-Christian tradition is tithing 10%. The Islamic tradition, zakat, is to give 1/40th of your net worth, of your wealth, each year, 2.5%. You know, for people who are wealthier, that is a much more challenging ask, actually. And so what I suggest in the book is, look, these religions have actually these amounts are a kind of messy compromise of between a challenging moral duty and what people can actually manage to do if they really try. And for me, they actually have a huge benefit of, if you put that out there as a thing that you should do, and when you've done that, your financial obligations are satisfied. That gets you out of the guilt that I have personally felt my whole life of that generosity is an invitation to a pit of endless obligation. Like, you can never enjoy a latte again because there's someone on the other side of the world who could have used that money. That kind of obligation is never going to spread. You know, we have to deal with humans as they are. You have to do things that, moral rules that people can aspire to. Religions have proved that people can achieve these goals. So, what would happen if you adopted and said, okay, you're a non-religious person, do you want your ethical standards to be at least as high as those of religious people? I vote yes on that. And that means there's a case that you should adopt the higher of those two standards. And if people did that, by the way, if a third of people did that who were comfortably off, it would raise so much philanthropy that every single problem outstanding to humans could be tackled to the extent that philanthropy can make a difference. There's an absolutely, like for me, the whole philanthropic conversation should shift from obligation to thrilling dreams about how we can make the world better. So yeah, so I have signed up on that pledge. There's a website, givingwhatwecan.org, that you can go onto it and you can make a public signing, and we kind of need that to sort of, you know, keep us honest to it. But I got a lot of joy from it, and it's actually taken away a lot of my guilt. I think I can do this. It's challenging, but I can do it. And I can proselytize it and try and encourage others to do it, because I just think it's an achievable moral standard, not for everyone in every stage of life, but people who have got to the point where we're reasonably comfortable, that is a laudable and achievable goal.
Well, I found your book fascinating and thoughtful and inspiring and sometimes provocative and very necessary for this horrific age that we're hopefully coming out of.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
So thank you. And we now have 25 minutes for questions. There's a few questions coming in from online, but does anybody have any questions in the audience? I see somebody. Should we have the house lights on for the questions? And there's somebody, yes, hi. Is there a mic? Is there a roving mic?
Apparently there is.
Oh, good. Okay.
I quite agree with you about generosity and the way it leads to gratitude, which leads to more generosity. Absolutely. I've known that in my own life and benefited hugely from it. I'm also very optimistic that ideas can make the world a better place. And I want to offer you very generously a free idea, because I know it works. I've done it again in my own life, and I know you have the right connections to make it work more generally. And that is that, yes, you're right that people love giving away money to good causes. They also love commemorating people and celebrating people. If, when the Queen died, Prince Charles, the King, had said, I am putting £5 million into a fund to plant trees, and I would like anyone else who respected or cared about the Queen to give money to it, there would have been £1 billion in a charity to plant trees. If Charles. David Attenborough had a clause in his will that said, if you've enjoyed my documentaries and would like to help with environmental or climate causes, please give to his charity. Again, there would be a huge amount of money. The same would apply for Mick or Paul or Obama or any of these people, and it could become a fashion among very famous people such as you know.
Well,
and
thank
we could
you.
Have a huge amount of money on a regular basis.
Infectious generosity via commemoration like that. But yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question.
Okay, there's down here in the front row, then after that a gentleman right behind, yes. Hi.
Hi. Slightly weird question. I'm a person with a disability, and quite often people inflict their kindness and generosity on me, and it's unwanted, it's generally unhelpful. That thing that people don't really know what they're doing, they're just doing it because they feel like they should. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, it speaks to the point about, you know, how Mr. Beast does it well, but then his copyists don't. And there's a very fine line, it feels, between doing it well and doing it badly.
I mean, people, it's probably done from good intention. You know, the question is that you don't feel respected when they do it. It feels a little bit demeaning. And I think it's a challenge generally in culture. Like, I think there's actually a generosity in receiving a gift to assume good intent from the person and respond as well. So it's very awkward. I think you should help us understand what is the way that people should and can best respect you and celebrate you. Is there a different kind of help that should be given? I think part of it is just we've got to get better at having honest conversations with each other, and it's very helpful to hear from you right now that, you know, that if you see someone who's in need, like, it's not necessarily true that the best thing you should do is kind of insult them by doing something that they actually they're perfectly capable of doing themselves. But we need to get wiser on this. You've inspired me. I think we need to. I need to find someone who can give some kind of playbook of what is the line between kindness and respect. And it sounds like you. So write to me and tell me what that is.
Hi. Do you have a mic in your hand? Oh, you do now.
I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about how philanthropy in the past can be used to obscure slightly dodgy tax arrangements by various billionaires.
Yeah. Including, you know, people who've come to TED.
Yeah, so big philanthropy is a huge issue, and it's regarded with so much cynicism, and for totally understandable reasons. First of all, we all resent wealth inequality and the fact that some people may get a tax benefit or reputation benefit, you know, there are so many reasons to be angry at big philanthropy. I push back on it a bit in the book because for a couple of reasons. One is that I think it's going to take forever to press for a world where fair taxes are paid and say, you know, we tax away billionaires and just let governments solve all the problems that can be solved. First of all, I'm not even sure that governments, their track record of solving big problems isn't that great either. And I have spent time talking to people who are rich, including billionaires, and they have, some of them are, you know, questionable intent, let's say, but a lot genuinely are committed to trying to figure out how to give back publicly. And so my feeling actually is that our stance should be not, don't do that, don't give away money like that. It should be to encourage much more philanthropy from them, with this caveat, to engage, to accept and agree that everyone should have a stake in how that philanthropy is planned and dreamed of. I think what's really annoying is the thought that some rich person on a whim can choose how to change the world. And so, you know, I've been involved in this thing called the Audacious Project, where we try and find projects that are independently sourced. We go to heroic people who are out there at the cliff face trying to change the world for the better and say to them, instead of going through all these god-awful fundraising meetings, spending half your time doing that, what could you and your team achieve if money was no object? You get amazing answers from them. You get those ideas that put goosebumps on the back of your neck. Help turn those into workable plans and then go to rich donors and say, okay, this independently, these are amazing ideas. Will you support these? And what I've found is that there is a form of infectious generosity, which is amazing to see, which is when you bring a group together and say, how about this? One person will say, okay, I'm persuaded. And others will come in, ping, 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 and ping. And it's actually beautiful to see. And they find the process inspiring. And I don't know, my vision of what I think there's a huge role in the future for more philanthropy of the right kind. I think there's a class of problems that the market can't solve, that governments so far have done a terrible job of solving, and that it needs big dreams and big money to try to do it. And I think when you see those problems solved, it's actually thrilling. There's a satellite launching in a couple of weeks' time that was funded by this very process that it's a thing, you know, like the size of a washing machine. It will detect methane emissions around the entire planet to a much greater level of precision than is possible before, so that companies can be identified, they can find it and turn off the loss of this valuable product to them. This is a product which is causing pretty much as much global warming in the short term as CO2. Like, it's a terrible problem. It's funded by a bunch of rich donors getting excited by a very carefully elaborated plan from the Environmental Defense Fund to do it. And there are so many other big, exciting ideas like that out there. So I say we spend so much time snarking and getting annoyed. Let's do it the other way. Let's get excited about the possibilities here and urge people with resources to raise their game. And I think we'll all feel better. And I think problems get solved.
Well, you say there's no perfect way of giving.
There's no perfect way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi. Gentleman there with the beard.
Thanks for the engaging talk, guys. attention is the currency. Are we reducing everything to sound bites? And I think the technologies don't cater really for nuance. You know, when we talk about courage, you know, I've had the courage to stand up and ask this question. So the sort of Mr. Beast replicas. Does Mr. Beast just have very thick skin? How do we deal with the sort of deficiency in handling nuance?
Yeah.
I think he does. But he's also got... Look, he puts out a video and then clicks back an hour later and 5 million new people watched it. That thickens your skin right there. You know you're doing something right. I think with so many things, it's a muscle. You know, I've been online shamed. It is the most horrifying thing. It makes you want to throw up and whatever, but it strengthens you for the next time. And and so I just think we start with something small and then raise the stakes a little bit each time.
And I've got to say, if you are being online shamed, like I've been online shamed, and once in a while, you know, you read the comments and you think, okay, yeah, they've got a point. And I think a little bit of humility rather than constant, like, fuck you know, doubling down, escalating rage, that sort of narcissistic rage that I think most of the leaders of the culture war suffer from. There is another way, and I think, you know, sometimes listening to, you know, sometimes if you're being publicly shamed, maybe they've got a bit of a point. I say that personally. Like, my book, Say You've Been Publicly Shamed, had one criticism that I thought, yeah, you know what, that's a kind of hard... Somebody said it was too situational. My book was too situational and it wasn't systemic enough. It wasn't enough about systemic problems. And I thought, okay, that's a very good point. So, yeah, I think a bit of humility, too, is probably good.
I completely agree with that. I've learned from critics. I think a useful thing that I try and keep in my head is discomfort is a proxy for progress. Like, you sometimes just need that kick to make the hard decisions.
Yeah. Hi, there's a woman who's here with her arm up with black. Yes. Hi.
We watch a lot of Mr. Beast in our house, so all good there. I just had a question on something you mentioned about religion and societies. I used to work in Soviet Russia, and there was a real sort of absence of religion there. And there was a lot of sort of anecdotes, you know, if you don't work, you don't eat, which the government had introduced to try and sort of replace that moral sort of lethargy. So I just wanted to know if you had any comments on that or any thoughts that there was actually an experiment about a lack of religion.
Not sure we should make godless Russia our sort of moral example here. Like, I haven't heard that actually worked that well. But it is. It shows, you know, that like it's hard. You know, if you don't motivating humans to survive life in the modern era, it's just hard. It's like that's the first thing. Life is hard. We evolved for a different world, and by the way, that world was even more terrifying. Life is hard for most creatures, and we it's a lot. You know, it's adopt the right assumption. And right there, things can start to get better. Any good thing that happened, arguably, is a reason to feel a little bit of gratitude and joy. But I may be missing some of the key brilliance of that particular model, but I'm not advocating at this point.
Mm-hmm. Hi, gentleman there in the plaid. God, I'm bad at describing what people...
That's okay, I'll take the plaid. There have been quite a lot of scandals with charities over the past few years. Mm. Millions of people donate money to a charity and then money goes missing or it's misused. And you can argue about whether that's deliberate or a misstep. I'm an optimist, I like to think often it's a misstep. But that's eroded a lot of trust in charities. So how do you make sure you're donating to the right cause? Or how do we rebuild trust in charities so people continue to be philanthropic?
Yeah, and could I add something to that question, a question that came in online, which is what do you think of the effective altruism movement? And obviously, the effective altruism movement took a bit of a bashing with Sam Bankman-Fried recently.
Yeah, it did. So look, one problem with charity, most people's charitable giving right now, is that we do it on impulse. You know, you see some tragedy on TV and you think, oh my gosh, I've got to text my £100 or whatever it is. What I argue for is that we need to be more reflective in what we do. We can't just, like, these feelings of empathy that we have, super powerful, super important, they can motivate us, but we need to shape it. As with everything, bring your reflective mind to bear. And that includes checking out who you're giving money to. I think the stories about charitable, you know, loss or you know, disaster or mishandling, probably as a percentage of total charitable giving, are probably way overwrought. I think there's a glee that some journalist taken, discovering something. I mean, it's, and anything you can do to have a reason not to give charitably is probably a great thing to notch up. But I also think that there is an order of magnitude difference or more between charities that are effective and those that aren't. So, effective altruism. I mean, if you ask the basic question, would we rather our altruism was effective or not effective? I'd rather mine was effective. And so if you talk to people like Will McCaskill, the founder of EA, he will say, at heart, we are not a set of, you know, this is what you must give to. We're a process. We're a process for saying to people, here's how you can figure out whether what you're doing is effective. And he asks great questions like, you know, is this a big problem that really needs solving? Has this organization come up with a really powerful way of solving that problem? And is this a problem that is already plenty funded? So there are smart questions you can ask. There's one question which people tend to ask, which is a terrible question to ask, which is, am I certain this is the best possible use of my charitable money? The answer to that question will always be no. You can never know what all the other possible uses are. And this question is regularly used to delay giving. So a much better question is am I pretty confident that this is a good use of my charity? Because here's the thing. The chances are, I mean, nothing is risk-free. The chances are having money out there in the world supporting someone who has given their life to trying to make the world a better place is probably a better place for it than sitting sleepily in your bank account. This doesn't apply to everyone. Many people are fighting, you know, to get through the month. That is good. There are other ways to be generous. But for people who do have money that's sleeping in their bank account, for God's sake, you know, at least think about it. And it's worth investing the time to find the charities that are credible. Find the communities. Like, supporting a nonprofit for the long term means joining a community of other supporters. There's huge joy in that, by the way. And you will learn from them. No, I've known this founder for years. They are the real deal. That's where I get confidence.
Oh, there's somebody over there. Yeah, wearing a kind of white thing.
Mm-hmm. Coat. Firstly, massive thank you. I feel moved beyond words by a lot of what you've said. And my question speaks to a number of themes that have come up in the questions. I found myself in this weird situation a few years ago of running a philanthropic organisation for a wealthy private equity guy. And I sensed early on that the money wasn't necessarily going, or there was something, it wasn't quite right, didn't feel right. So I did this mapping thing, and I sort of looked at a few foundations and trusts, and I came up with these two axes. One was intervention, and the other one was longevity. And it seemed to me that there was possibly a way of understanding the effectiveness of philanthropy that looked at these two axes. And I want to ask you, based on everything that you've done, everything that you've said tonight, the fear that a couple of people who've asked questions about the horrible tax evasions and why would people be so stupid treating people with disabilities in a certain way, could you do something with your tech knowledge to do a mapping exercise and spread the word widely using an algorithmic intelligence that would show all those seemingly generous, lovely private equity men and women actually whether their money and whether their intention of getting super involved when they didn't know what they were talking about was actually going into any good at all? And could you be the person to actually move the dial with effective philanthropy?
With great pleasure. Possibly next Tuesday. I mean, look, this is... The future is really hard to shape reliably. It is hard to know for sure how to act so as to make change. We live in this world full of these complex systems. Everything has some uncertainty to it. Everything can have unintended consequences. So... I think that our best shot is actually, it's not one person, it's all of us embracing the fact that this is actually a really important and exciting conversation. Spend more time talking about it with each other. And we can get to wisdom, at least enough wisdom, as to what we individually can do. And thank you so much for your nice comments as well. Thank you.
Yes. There's two things I forgot to say. Please tweet, it's a bit late now, but please tweet about the event using the hashtag IQ2. And also, online audience, you can ask a question by clicking on the Q&A button under the video screen, then press send. We only have 5 minutes left, so I've kind of screwed that up. Hi.
Hi. So you talked about, like, the pros and cons of the sort of surveillance internet, and I think a lot of the conversation of that has evolved around, like, being very anti-cancel culture. And so recently, especially for me, the conversation about anti-bullying at my school has become really just like, if someone does something that's upset you, you just need to forgive them instantly. Like, you can't, like, be upset with them, you can't stop being friends with them. Like, cancel culture is just completely bad, and I don't think that that's very productive. Like,
no, how do you think that's the pendulum swinging very wildly. Yeah.
How do you think that the conversation should be taught to young people like myself? Because I don't think that the way that it's done is working right now.
Curiosity. Like, people are always, you know, people... I think curiosity and patience. But if you're being bullied, then, you know, people should feel shame for doing bad things.
Yeah, there's nothing that says that people who are bad actors should be let off the hook. Yeah. You know, generosity is inside us, kindness is inside us, but it is also packaged with a strong sense of fairness. Every human culture does not allow cheaters and freeloaders. That's bad. You know, we have to have means of dealing with them appropriately. So it's that there's no one-size-fits-all thing here. Try to find kindness. Try to find good intention in what someone does. But if someone is really being obnoxious and it's not there, then we need collectively to let them know that.
Hi. There's one coming right there.
Hi. Thank you very much for the amazing talk. I'm curious to know your opinion about the idea of, when it comes to philanthropy with the purpose of economic redistribution of wealth, what is your view on the idea that I can redistribute wealth by spending? So, for example, we live in London, so every time you go to theater, you're supporting actors and actresses and anyone in that domain versus making a donation to an art institute. So I know it's a long debate, but I'm curious to know what you think. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think transactional spending in an economy, I mean, if you believe Adam Smith, you know, all boats rise to a certain extent. You're helping create jobs and so forth. You're also getting back direct benefit yourself. And I think a lot of our spending is perfectly healthily done that way. I just think there's also a category for different kinds of spending where you don't get an immediate benefit back, which allows you more flexibility as to who to support. And there's whole categories of organizations that can't give back services or immediate material goods to the people who donate them, but who are doing amazing work. We need both.
Now, does anybody have... We've got time for just one more question. Does anybody have a question that they know? Well, it's going to have to be you because you put your arm up in the most vociferous way. But I'm hoping this final question... I hope your question is going to be...
amazing.
Yeah, you.
Amazing.
It's going to be like an amazing last
question.
It's going to leave people on like a wave, like a surfing wave of
joy. I'm feeling it, John.
Joy.
I'm feeling it.
Well, now I'm nervous. My question was... So one of the things you talked about, I thought was a really great idea, this concept of radical generosity. And if we can give away our ideas or our art, for example, that could cause ripple effects. But I couldn't help but think a little bit about the debate going on at the moment about AI. And for example, how these AI algorithms that are producing art are kind of using the artwork of artists without compensating them for that. And so my question is that then maybe like a question of short-term versus long-term, as in the short-term, I guess a lot of artists are being screwed over, but in the long-term, it's creating this AI algorithm that could be of use to the world. Is that a debate, or what are your thoughts?
It's a very good question, because actually you speak a bit about this in the book, and it's another sort of slightly provocative point that you make about whether AI is going to make things worse or whether AI could fix the problem. So I think that's this is a very good yeah. place to end on.
I mean, AI is changing the world so quickly that I definitely, no one can really claim to be an expert of any kind on this. I think my main advice to anyone is just to pay very, very close attention. And if you can, spend time with some of the AI tools and just play with them, because the chances are that if you can figure out the language of prompting and kind of thinking about what pulls the best of AI, it's going to be incredibly beneficial to you. There's no simple answer to your question. I think it's horrible that some artists and creatives are going to get, in a way, ripped off by it and are going to have to radically change how they do their work. Others, many other people who have a creative bug in them will be able to be amazingly creative thanks to AI. There's going to basically be massive changes, and we need to look out for each other and pay attention to each other. It's going to be wild. The future may or may not be horrible or wonderful. It's definitely going to be amazing. Yeah. And in terms of radical generosity, one simple thing, honestly, that you could do if you don't do anything else, if this is all kind of overwhelming, is just engage in the ancient generosity tradition of hospitality. Invite 6 friends to dinner and just have a great time together and have a single conversation around that table about what do you care about and what do you, in our local community, who have you noticed who could maybe use some help? Is there something cool going on in our community that we could help? I promise you that the act of collaborating with a group of people, noticing something and going in together and maybe surprising that person with support, it will light up their life, it will light up your life, and it may make a huge ripple effect across the community. That would be a beautiful, beautiful piece of radical generosity to just try as an experiment. And, you know, and if something happens, honestly, let me know. We're trying, I think all of us, we need to do this stuff, and then we need to share stories. You hear a story about something, share it. You may not get John's views ever. I won't ever get your views. Your 5 million listens.
Right.
Listens to your podcast.
I thought you meant my opinions.
You know. No. You are Mr. Ripple Maker Extraordinary.
Thank you.
But you will make ripples. You will make ripples. And it will, and collectively, that could be really beautiful.
Well, I've got to say, I was intimidated. When Chris asked me to do this, one of the reasons why I was intimidated was because, I don't know if anybody's ever seen Chris interview somebody on stage. I think Chris is the best on-stage interviewer that I've ever seen. And so to be his on-stage interviewer was a very intimidating thing. But I think you did a wonderful job of talking about your book, which is so necessary in these horrendous times, and I really hope that people were inspired by some of the things that Chris said and enjoyed the conversation. And Chris will be signing books in the back of the room, former church in our post-religious society. So please do stick around and meet Chris and get your book signed. And thank you all so much for coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.